Sylvia Richardson is my guest for tonight. Sylvia, are you there?
Yes, I am. Charles?
Yes, she is there. Okay, Sylvia. Sylvia, thanks for dropping in and saying hello to us from where? Out in Burnaby somewhere.
Yes.
Well, okay, glad we've got you. Okay, Sylvia Richardson, just let me tell folks, Sylvia is a PhD student. She's in arts education, faculty of education up at SFU, and she's a host of a program called Latin Waves. Now, I have before me, Sylvia, a book cover with a paint. Is it a painting?
Yes.
It's a painting of a face that looks fractured. And it kind of, like, it looks like a duplication, but it looks like it's sort of fractured. There's some technique that's been used to quite haunted eyes, and I would say distressed look on her face. And it's called Flesh Mapping, Cartography of Struggle, Renewal, and Hope in Education. That's your new book.
Yes.
Well, tell us, first of all, a little bit about the book, Sylvia, right off the top. Tell us what kind of book it is and what one would find in it if you were to open the cover.
Mm. Well, first of all, I'd like to thank you for the invitation, Charles. And I want to say that Flesh Mapping is my response to the kind of violence that we live today in a society living in the era of neoliberalism. And so it's the story of an academic such as myself going through the academy, but it's more than that. It's the story of the immigrant. It's the story of a child escaping from war. It's the story of us struggling to contend with the violence imposed by, I would say, an academic arrogance that denies the voices of ordinary people. And so the book really is an invitation for us who consider ourselves progressives, for people who struggle every day in minimum wage jobs, to envision what a walking together, what society could look like, who and what we can be, you know, when we stand together, and to realize that this era is not static, it can change. And so what you find in the book is the multiple stories that inform who I am today as an activist, who I am today as a scholar, who I am today as an artist.
So, Sylvia, is this a book of short stories? Is it fiction? Is it poetry? Tell, you know, really just kind of give the sort of basics of it. Because when I'm looking at the book outline, it has a number of chapters and it has different names. It says Living as Praxis, The Age of Innocence, Chapter 2, Tough Times, Chapter 3, Seeds of Discontent. So what are these chapters? Are these, is it an essay, an argument, or is it a work of fiction?
Well, I guess we would say that all stories are fiction. And I would argue that all research is storytelling. And the reason why I make that claim is that the book is a series of stories. It's a way of looking through one life and the multiple scars that sort of mark, you know, the define. It's an autographical story, so it's the story of my life, but it's the story of multiple people who are part of that story. And so in using the term flash mapping, I'm kind of using the word mapping subversively, right? Mapping has always been a colonizing process of demarcating the land and instantly creating this barriers between one another. You know, of defining a place that we call home as a country or a place that has borders. And so in many ways, the word is being used subversively to co-opt it, to realize that just the way that maps divide us and create abstract ideas about whose life, who belongs where, you know, who the stranger is among us. Also, the scars that are imposed on our bodies by war, by hunger, by poverty, also are sites of identification. And in this case, the mapping of those stories, the mapping of those scars, is a way of locating us. It's a way of finding one another, of, you know, finding a way to hear our voices, you know, in this world that, you know, tends to alienate us through economic policies, through institutional, hierarchical ways of seeing and understanding each other.
You know, that's a very interesting and important topic for everyone who lives anywhere between Tierra del Fuego and the Arctic North Pole. Because this whole huge landmass was occupied by myriad nations of people with their languages, their culture, their way of life. And they've been here for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And they actually, in their own manner, mapped the area. Mm-hmm. Like I was, because I was having a conversation with a Kutnaka or Kootenai elder from the Columbia Basin area, and there, and so, and then we were talking about, you know, geography and so on. And he says, "Well, you people don't think we had boundaries, but we had boundaries. We knew what was Kootenai territory. We knew what was Blackfoot territory." We knew who was who and who was where. And then you, colonial settlers from Europe, who had gone through your own nation-building business in Europe, brought all your prejudices of maps and lines, and you drew all lines around this humongous territory for possession purposes, for establishing who ruled what. By conquest, or because often it wasn't like here that indigenous people tell you, Sylvia, well, there was no conquest. We were never conquered. Who the hell are you talking about? So do you know what I'm saying? So there's a whole lot to be discussed about mapping and drawing boundaries in this world that we live in, that we inhabit. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your personal story? If it's a little bit autobiographical, why don't you share your life a little bit with us and tell us where you came from and some of the conditions that you experienced when you were a youth, a child, and then coming to Canada and so on.
In telling the story of who I am, I'm telling the story of multiple people. I'm telling you the story of my parents. I'm telling you the story of the different communities that form who I am. So I guess my story... And all stories really are fragments, right, of locating ourselves where we are. And I began by locating myself among a people, you know, who I call members of the landless and poor. And because my parents were incredibly talented people, incredibly creative. But their skills and their abilities were constantly devalued in a society of markets, in a society that recognizes privilege and power, but doesn't recognize the way the workers, you know, form and create the world. So I'll tell the story the way I tell it in my book, because the stories of ordinary people are the stories of extraordinary lives, of living with no water, of, you know, making meals out of nothing, you know, of gathering leaves and making something of substance that sustains your children when your lands have been ravished by mining companies, of creating art out of, you know, the the remnants that you find around you, of seeing beauty in what others consider garbage, what others would in a colonial setting may not appreciate. So it's recognizing that the poor are hungry not because they're not hardworking, not because they're not striving, but because we live in what I call you know, a society that creates markets of want. And so I begin my story by writing a poem, and I write, "To be poor is to know hunger, like stabbing needles piercing the depth of your stomach, like battery acid, corrosive fire that consumes you. Listen, you will hear the chorus. We can't afford to increase the minimum salary for workers. We can't afford to increase funding for education. We cannot afford to create full employment. We certainly cannot afford to provide clean water. We can't afford to provide food for children. Dying of hunger-related diseases. We cannot afford to provide generic drugs to alleviate the suffering of AIDS victims in Africa. And we certainly can't afford to cut down CO2 emissions of extractive industries. And we, on and on it goes, right? We hear the stories all the time. You know, we are living in that moment today where in the midst of the worst economic crisis, we are told we have to cut even more to the sustaining fabrics of society, to the infrastructure that is it's barely sustaining our society today. So I see the world through these relationships. I don't see the world through independent moments. I see them as interconnected. And so from my poem, I ask the question, because I see this world as being cut in the fly of in the flypaper of capitalism, you know, where poverty and hunger becomes destiny as we become stagnant, choked to death by walls and violence, the way a river dies slowly, silenced by dams.
Mm.
Isn't the time we flow?
Now, do you mind, where were you raised as a child?
El Salvador.
All right. So El Salvador is well known to Canadians, I think, by and large. It's the smallest country in Central America, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But it has a very large population. It has an ancient indigenous population, which was practically obliterated. I think the Wikipedia says it lost about 80% of its indigenous population by 1520 through smallpox and so on, not unlike British Columbia, right?
That's right.
So there's that trauma that must be part of the consciousness of the people. Plus, El Salvador was dragged through quite a bitter civil war for a period of time in the 1980s. Is that correct? And so that left some scars as well. And then most recently, there has been a kind of a hope in a resistance against the neoliberal agenda, as I understand it, through the new president, or the not so new president, but the man who was elected from the left. Tell me the name of the government, the ruling party there.
Well, the FMLN, which came out of the resistance movement, has been elected. So your former terrorist, as you know, the government in Canada likes to call it, is now the government, right? And so it depends on how you want to who you want to discriminate against. But in reality, the FMLN under Funes, the FMLN finally came to power in 2009. Now, what we have to remember is that our stories are interlinked, our stories are interconnected, and El Salvador went through a bloody period during the 1980s. It was called the Dirty Wars, and not just El Salvador, but Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador in particular. I would say Guatemala and El Salvador were particularly impacted by the brutality of the war and how the genocide was conducted. Over 150,000 people died in El Salvador. More than 200,000 people dying in Guatemala. And that doesn't even speak. And I hate doing that. I hate saying those numbers, because those are not just numbers. Those are people. Those are families that were impacted. Those are communities that were destroyed. And so to tell that story is to understand the processes that terror brings, the power that is productive. We always think that, you know, these places are just violent. Oh, isn't it curious how in some places there's such violence? People don't talk about El Salvador today, but if you look at the world, there are places where the homicide rates are so high, and we're not at war. We had a peace accord signed, you know, brokered by Canada in the 1990s. And now we have more inequality, higher unemployment, more hunger, and more people being killed on a regular basis than during the war. So what was achieved, you know? And those are the questions that I ask, right? Because our stories are interconnected, are complex. The policies that are being made in Canada to advance the interests of mining companies are directly impacting the lives of people in El Salvador, are directly impacting the ability of people to survive. We have one major river, the Rio Lempa, and hydrological estimations say that the river has approximately 70 years, right? They do this test of how long the river will be able to supply and provide you know, life to that community. And when you think about the number of dams that have been put on this river, this directly connects to the expansion of mining. Now, El Salvador did one thing with the election of Funes. It was the first country to declare a ban on mining. And this audacity of a small country daring to say no to something that is so directly intricate to, you know, the survival of its people, has been met with a lot of aggression. We are seeing El Salvador being dragged through an international court, you know, calling this action as an aberration to trade agreements, and so there's a lawsuit. But the lawsuit, to me, is only part of the story. Because when we as workers ignore how our money is being invested in mining companies, how those mining companies produce and create cancer in the populations that are forced to live there, in the lands that are being appropriated, and the people who are being displaced, we are missing the story. Whether the mining company gets the permit is irrelevant, just like in Canada. If we are unable to stop the tar sands, if we're unable to connect our struggles for dignity, if we're unable to recognize that the struggle to live in a society that has safe food to eat, clean water to drink, clean air to breathe, that those things are interconnected, and that my life is not more important than someone who lives in the tar sand, than someone who lives in Calgary, than someone who lives in El Salvador, then, you know, only then can we move together. Only then can we create and imagine different possibilities. So that's the story that I'm telling. I'm telling you my story, not so that you can know my story, because my story is not just mine. It's the story of all those people together.
Well, there certainly is a lot of interconnectedness, no doubt about that, Sylvia, especially with modern capitalism. It's a very highly technically sophisticated society. Its communication systems are very, very complex. Plus, air transport, you can move mining officials. I would assume a mining executive has got his private executive jet. He can zip down from Vancouver to Salvador in El Salvador in, what, 5, 6 hours, 7 hours, whatever, and, take command of his project. Is this gold and copper that they're taking out of the mine in El Salvador?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a gold mine, yeah.
A gold mine. Yeah, and is it a Canadian gold? Is it?
Yeah, it's Pacific Rim.
Pacific Rim.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Goldcorp is in Honduras and in Guatemala.
Yeah, well, Canadian mining companies going after base metals are huge, and they are very, very profitable. And so there is this really arrogant, you can say, empire-building mentality, imperialist mentality. And of course, they're all now embroiled in what they call corporate social responsibility. That's the new catchphrase. Sylvia, have you caught that new catchphrase recently? Corporate social responsibility. In other words, when you look at the mining that they're doing in El Salvador, you just don't know it, Sylvia, but they are being very responsible, and then they'll give you all the bullshit, right? But in reality, like you said, the river's being choked, people's lives are being diminished, their dignity is being run roughshod over. And even when a small country like that says, we don't want mining, they drag you through the courts and as a violator of so-called trade agreements. They're not trade agreements at all, they're investment agreements, which are imposed by the biggest powers over the weaker and smaller countries, generally speaking, by the big, powerful countries.
I, I just want to say that, you know, well, we need to be very aware that power consolidates privilege in the hands of just very few, that power isn't static. That's what we have demonstrated in El Salvador. That's what people are demonstrating in Bolivia. That's what people are demonstrating in Venezuela. And power can also be overturned. Power can also be from the bottom up. Power can be brought into being a power with rather than a power over, which is the kind of power that capitalism imposes. And what I'm asking, you know, and it really is only an invitation, but what I'm asking is that we have a bigger imagination, that we imagine, you know, what we are told is impossible, that we imagine ourselves walking together, you know, for justice, you know, in a way to live in coexistence, to live as the Bolivian people, the Aymara people say, to finally live in coexistence, to live well, not better, but to recognize that in order to do that, we all have to, you know, create a foundation of responsibility, a foundation where we are interdependent on one another and care for one another. You know, and Martin Luther King said it long ago, that if we are to have peace on earth, our loyalties must transcend our race, our tribe, our class, our nation. We have to, at some point, become radical community members, you know, meaning at the roots, and really strive to create not just human liberation, but to also liberate ourselves from this obsession to dominate Mother Nature and to recognize that we're interdependent and we are part of nature. So we have to change the ways we conceive the economy, the ways we imagine our social relations, so that we are truly able to live with dignity. You can't have dignity in Canada when we are imposing mining and the deaths of children in El Salvador and Honduras. You can't expect to have peace and in a world, a society without violence, when we're imposing, you know, economic policies of austerity in third world country, as they call it. There's no such thing as a third world. There's one world, and places where, you know, the countries are being asked to forego their malaria treatment to pay an IMF loan, which is, you know, already questionable how those loans have come up to gain those interests. So the question for us is, like, what are, we know all those things, but what are we going to do together? How are we going to move together? And I think the reason I wrote the book is because before we can walk together, we need to know one another. We need to learn to recognize who are the immigrants. Why would people risk their lives? Why would people risk living a place where they're recognized, where they're respected, where they're loved, where they have a connection to the place of their birth, to go somewhere else where they're where they're treated with disregard, where they're alienated and discriminated? And the reason is, people don't choose. That's not a choice. People are forced to walk a journey to achieve justice. And many of us are still wandering and walking. For most people I work with, more as a radio journalist, most of the people I work with are people who have lived courageous lives, who have struggled against terrible odds. But we do it joyously. We recognize that those scars, those things that define our lives, are also our teachers. They also teach us to live with dignity. They also teach us that dignity is lived. We walk it or it dies. So in many ways, our struggle for liberation is a struggle to recognize our humanity is dependent on that ability to recognize one another and to stand with others. Settlers, you know, settler populations here in Canada, if we want to have a sustained system, a system of dignity, we need to ally our efforts behind First Nations people. We need to recognize that we're not going to liberate other people, but we walk together and live, and we liberate ourselves walking together in solidarity. Not as saviors, not as benevolent charity givers, but as, you know, as brothers and sisters, equals.
All right, I couldn't agree more. That's summed up, and there's a very famous song about that. It says, "No, we want no condescending saviors." Do you know that song? It's the International. It's a very famous song. Sylvia, we just have a minute, so I need you to tell our listeners where they can find your book. And I gather from your description, it's got some story narrative, it's got some poetry, it's got some polemical material, I'm assuming, something. It's telling a story, mm-hmm. right?
Flesh Mapping, the title of the book is Flesh Mapping, Cartography of Struggle, Renewal, and Hope in Education. The part about hope is that I'm looking at Paulo Freire, who is my mentor, and he said that the radical commitment to human liberation does not become the prisoner of a circle of certainty. So it's not that we know where we're going, but by walking, by doing, by learning to be respectful and humble of what we don't know, it's how we find the answers in the way. So the book is published by Peter Lang, and you can access it by going to Peter Lang Publishing out of New York. You can also find it on Amazon, but I would rather if you went directly to the publisher, Peter Lang Publishing.
How do you spell it, Sylvia?
Peter Lang? Yep. It's just Peter, L-A-N-G, Lang Publishing.
Okay.
Peter Lang Publishing or Amazon.
All right. Well, listen, thank you for being with me for the last half hour.
Thank you, Charles. I really appreciate your time. And to all your listeners, you know, walk with dignity. It means, you know, standing up. It's not always comfortable. It's not always easy, but it you know, we strengthen each other.